This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Various venues across Portland. The Portland, Oregon Old Time Music Gathering is a grassroots, volunteer-run festival that aims to celebrate and enrich the community of traditional, old-time Appalachian-style string band musicians. A list of performers, locations, and more information can be found at kboo.fm/2013oldtime.
KBOO Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland. KBOO will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kboo.fm/2013MLK.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, outrage mounts over the prosecution and suicide of progressive activist Aaron Schwartz.
School teachers in Seattle refuse to administer the MAP standardized test.
And another live update from the trial of alleged Christmas tree bomber Mohammed Mohammed.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 18th, 2013. I'm Linda Olsen Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. A week after the suicide of internet activist and hacker Aaron Schwartz, over 25,000 people have signed a petition calling for the removal of U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz. She prosecuted him for illegally downloading academic articles. The 26-year-old Schwartz was facing 13 felony charges, with a possible sentence of 35 years in prison and $1 million fine. His family released a statement calling his death, quote, the product of a criminal justice system rife with intimidation and prosecutorial overreach, unquote. They blamed the Massachusetts U.S. Attorney and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. KBOO's Zeke Harrington spoke with Dr. Richard Stallman, president of the Free Software Foundation, and visiting professor at MIT about the implications of Schwartz's case.
Do you agree with Aaron Schwartz's family's statement that the death of Aaron Schwartz is primarily a case of prosecutorial overreach?
I don't know if I would use that precise term. It's definitely the fault of the prosecutors because they threw the book at somebody who had done no real harm to anyone, and this is with so many serious crimes going on that tend to go unprosecuted. So that's what the wrong was. Overreach may be a more specific term. I think it was the decision to prosecute him at all that is their fault.
Do you feel that JSTOR's decision to not pursue charges should have been taken into account?
Absolutely. JSTOR recognized that prosecuting somebody who for trying to liberate the scientific literature that JSTOR bottles up was a really stupid thing to do because it would be an obvious injustice. It would show people how the existing system of scientific publication is wrong.
Now, MIT has announced an investigation into their response towards the incident. Do you expect them to change their policies as a result of this case?
I don't see the future. What I can think about is what's right and what's wrong. I know of a couple of things that MIT appears to have done that it shouldn't have done. First of all, the government investigators were brought in before MIT had figured out who was downloading the papers, but they did know that what was going on was downloading papers from JSTOR. And it's pretty clear that since these are available to the public, they're not secret, no great harm could happen. There was no need to bring in government investigators, and MIT should have made sure that did not happen. MIT should have had policies in place to make sure that it would find out what was going on before taking the decision to expose someone to possible prosecution. That's one change MIT needs to make. However, later on, for instance, last summer, people tried to convince MIT to say the same thing that JSTOR was saying, please stop attacking this young man. And MIT was somewhat hard-hearted because he was not an MIT affiliate. Well, that's another policy that has to change.
Carmen Ortiz, the U.S. attorney in this case, has responded to criticism of her handling of the prosecution by saying that stealing is stealing, whether you use a computer command or a crowbar.
I read that statement, and she was ducking the issue. The point is, it was her decision whether to prosecute him or one of thousands of other criminals that might be available to prosecute. Which cases should be prosecuted and which should not be are the decision that she was supposed to make. We need to put an end to the practice of locking up the scientific literature. We've got to give everyone the freedom to redistribute scientific papers to the public, and we have to put pressure on the publishers that won't do this. The pressure that's easiest to do is refuse to publish in those journals, refuse to review for them, refuse to work for them at all. There's a law that the research funded by the National Institutes of Health has to be published in a way that at least allows the public to get a copy of it. But that's not all government-funded research. We've got to push for victory in this campaign. We've got to put an end to locking up scientific literature the way JSTOR does. This is the way to honor Aaron Swartz's memory.
I've been speaking with Dr. Stallman, president of the Free Software Foundation. This is Zeke Harrington with KBOO News.
Across the country, parents and educators have long questioned the emphasis federal programs and public schools put on standardized tests. One of those tests is called MAP, or the Measure of Academic Progress, and multiple times a year, thousands of students take the computer-based exam. But one school in Seattle is now refusing to administer the MAP test. FSRN's Jill Friedberg has more.
At Garfield High School in Seattle's historically black Central District neighborhood, incoming freshmen take the MAP 2 to 3 times a year.
It's a really memorable test because you have to skip an entire class period with your class, and your entire class has to go into the computer lab.
Kat, a Garfield junior, took the MAP 3 times in her freshman year.
There was a lot of stuff on the test that I had never touched on before. Math problems that I'd never seen before and stuff that I just had no chance to solve.
These algebra students come in and sit down in front of a computer and they're looking at geometry questions. The score doesn't mean anything if it doesn't match the curriculum.
Chris McBride is Garfield's testing coordinator and academic counselor. Last week, she joined Garfield teachers and staff in a unanimous vote to stop administering the Measure of Academic Progress, or MAP, test. Garfield teachers explained that the test robs students and teachers of valuable class time, costs the district millions of dollars, and fails to provide an accurate measure of student learning.
The test is not useful to my students.
In 26 years of teaching, this is the first time that English teacher Kit McCormick has refused to administer a test.
They get a score, and it says something like 229 on the RIT scale, and then they get a score 3 months or 6 months later that says 230 or 228. And they say, oh, I've gone up or I've gone down. And I look at the score and say, that's unreliable. And we've lost a whole lot of class time, and so I'm not going to do it.
Chris McBride, Garfield's testing coordinator, estimates that the MAP test takes 800 students out of 57 class periods per quarter at Garfield. Despite the weeks that are devoted to the MAP test, scores have no bearing on students' grades or ability to graduate, but they do affect teacher evaluations, even though the Northwest Evaluation Association, the company that produces the test, advises against using the MAP to measure teacher performance.
The tests, I think, are actually measuring some other things that we just don't admit that they're measuring.
Wayne Au is a Garfield graduate, an editor at Rethinking Schools, and assistant professor of education at the University of Washington.
You know, like access to educational opportunity or access to resources outside of school. When you take the best teacher in the world working with a group of all low-income kids, all the inequities in their lives will contribute to lower test scores, and then that teacher could be really good, but it doesn't matter because you won't necessarily see it.
Teachers in general want to move away from seeing kids as a test score, labeling them as a number.
Jesse Hagopian graduated from Garfield and returned to teach history there. He wonders how some of Garfield's more notable alumni might have fared on the test.
Jimi Hendrix and Bruce Lee and Quincy Jones. And I'm so glad that those people didn't have to take the MAP test and weren't labeled a number. Kids come to us from so many different backgrounds with so many different passions and interests and learning styles, many different intelligences that get neglected when you try to boil it down to A, B, C, or D.
In general, I've always felt that standardized testing measures a student's ability to take standardized tests.
Heidi Jackson has two daughters at Garfield High School. She thinks the teacher's decision to refuse the test serves as an important lesson for her kids.
Most importantly, they're demonstrating that when you stand behind something that you deeply believe, you're doing the right thing. And those kinds of lessons don't happen in the school environment really that often. We as parents need to be aware of how much influence our children's school experience has over them and how something like this can be a huge shift in how they see their own potential in making a difference.
The school district offices did not return requests for an interview, but in a statement, the new superintendent said that the district was already planning to review the effectiveness of the MAP test throughout the remainder of the school year, but that all teachers would be expected to administer the test by the end of February. Garfield's teachers do not know what repercussions they will face from the district if they don't administer the test. Since announcing their decision, they have received an outpouring of support from teachers and parents across Seattle and around the country.
The students will definitely rally behind the teachers if there's repercussions against the teachers.
Back in the home of Garfield student Kat, her mom and stepmom share their reaction to the teacher's decision.
We frankly find it amazing that they were able to put it all together. I mean, I just think it's awesome to refuse the test and to all come together and say, we will do this as a unit.
They're standing up for our kids.
Right.
And I support that.
On Monday, most of the teachers at ORCA, a Seattle K-8 school, announced their decision to join the Garfield teachers in refusing the test, and schools around the district plan to meet on the topic in the coming week. Jill Friedberg, FSRN, Seattle.
Dispatched yesterday to respond to a possible hijacking threat. The two F-15s accompanied an Alaska Airlines flight to Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, where authorities removed a passenger upon landing. The FBI said they had no plans to arrest the man after interviewing him for 2 hours. The airline crew reported that the man slept most of the way from Kona, Hawaii. A spokesperson for the FBI says the Bureau got a call yesterday afternoon telling them about the potential hijacker, but they now admit that the call appears to have been a hoax. They did not address questions on how they determine whether a threat is real or not. The last time U.S. fighter jets were scrambled to accompany a passenger plane was in November on a flight bound for Washington, D.C. In that incident, flight attendants called the FBI when a passenger began praying in the aisle of the plane.
As the trial of local teen Mohammed Mohammed moves into its second week, KBOO News continues its live coverage from the federal court in Portland. Mohammed is charged with attempting to blow up the Christmas tree lighting at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland in 2010. His attorneys argue that he was entrapped by FBI agents who spent more than a year trying to convince the 18-year-old to engage in violence. KABU's Joe Meyer is at the courthouse and joins us live with an update. Joe, are you there? It'll be just a second. We'll have Joe on the line. I have a question from, I believe Joe's on the line. Can you hear my question, Joe? Yesterday you mentioned that there was a videotape of an undercover agent talking with Mohammed about the defendant possibly having used drugs. Can you talk a little bit more about that and the implications of that if, in fact, it did happen for the case? I believe we're still having some technical difficulties. We will get back to this. This is, we're in the middle of what appears to be, or the end of the first week of what appears to be possibly a four-week trial. We've had Joe Meyer live at the court every day covering this for KABU News. And of course, you've been hearing about it in other locations. This case was written about by an author named Trevor Aronson. He is going to be live on KABU Monday morning at 9 a.m. He covered this story, Mohammed, in his book called The Terror Factory. So that's something you can look forward to in terms of more coverage, not just of the Mohammed case, but also of how the FBI has been using the same tactics throughout the country, tactics that many say involve entrapment, that they pick people who have thoughts and anger and desires to perhaps commit crimes, but who would never do it on their own. I believe we've got Joe Meyer there on the line with us now. Joe, are you there?
Hi, Linda.
Well, welcome, Joe. Thank you for being at the court for us here at KABU and bringing us your report. Joe, what I was saying earlier was yesterday you mentioned that there was a videotape of the undercover agent talking with Mohammed about Mohammed possibly having been on drugs, some reference to the use of drugs. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
It was a very brief reference. It was at the second meeting with both Yusuf and Hussein. It was towards the end of the meeting. Mohammed said, "You got anything to burn?" And the agent said, "By all means, go right ahead."
And so that sounds like a reference. It doesn't sound like, "Have you got a cigarette?" It does sound like a reference to it. What are the implications of that? Have the defense attorneys made anything of that yet?
Not explicitly. They seem to be tiptoeing around it. Today it came out that before the first meeting, Yusuf and the defendant disappeared for a few hours, and no one knows where they were. And one could guess they were getting stoned.
It would fit a pattern that is being brought out in this book called The Terror Factory of managing to not record conversations or try to hide parts of the of a sting operation that they don't think would sell well with a jury. Is that videotape going to be seen by the jury? Will they hear that reference?
I believe they already have.
All right.
Very brief, and if you don't travel in certain circles, you may not catch it.
Now, there was other evidence that was brought forward that the judge did refuse to allow into testimony. Can you talk about any of that?
Well, sure. Discovery of evidence, or what can be shown to the jury, has been a constant undercurrent during this first week of the trial. You know, almost every day before the jury is seated, there's 20 minutes of arguments about discovery. Just the past Monday, the defense asked about access to missing FBI emails from November 2009, and these may be especially important because Mohammed was only 17 at the time. The judge also made clear before the jury was seated again that no evidence from FBI planning meetings or debriefs will be allowed. The defense can ask the agents what happened, but cannot show evidence from these times. I'm not sure the details of why. We also learned that several times the FBI forgot to turn off their recording devices after the meeting with the defendant, and these so-called outtakes will also not be presented to the jury. But again, the defense can ask the agents what happened. You know, how do you remember that? And today, the defense started by requesting the ability to present a chain of FBI emails from January 2010. And the judge said, "Well, if you can condense it down to so many pages, I'll at least consider the proposal."
So that makes you concerned about what is it that the jury is not going to be able to hear and what difference would it make in terms of the outcome of the case. Can you talk about the makeup of that jury and how they've been reacting to the trial?
Well, they're pretty stone-faced in terms of makeup. I believe there are 9 women and 7 men. A few are openly not white, and it looks like Portland, basically. It looks like Portland.
Looks like a variety of ages?
A variety of ages, indeed.
All right, and they're not seeming to respond to any of the testimony so far?
Pretty stone-faced.
Okay.
Another interesting thing that came out today was we saw how the FBI uses silos of information where each agent sequentially has plausible deniability. For example, Agent Bill Smith, who contacted Muhammad earliest, wrote that the defendant was easily manipulated, confused, and religiously conflicted. Then Agent Youssef comes on the scene and says he didn't know anything about that. He was just talking to the kid. They were just getting to know each other. Then Agent Youssef meets with the defendant and gives him unknown instructions because all the tapes have been lost. And the next, Agent Hussein meets the defendant for the first time and hears the plan to target Pioneer Square from him. So then Hussein can plausibly say, oh, yeah, it was the defendant's idea.
So in other words, even though the idea may have been planted by a different informant, that one can get up and say, oh, no, the defendant had the idea initially.
Exactly.
Have the lawyers given any indication of what's going to happen next week at the trial? We've only got about a few more seconds left.
In a few more seconds next week, we're going to hear from a few more FBI agents, and we'll start on the expert testimony.
And what kind of expert testimony is expected?
I don't know from the government. The defense promised to bring in some psychology experts to show how the FBI was manipulating the defendant. But from the government, I'm not sure what they have in mind.
All right. Well, thank you, Joe Meyer. We've been speaking with KABU reporter Joe Meyer, reporting live from outside the federal courtroom in Portland, where Mohammed Mohammed is facing the potential of life in prison if found guilty of terrorism charges.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, a Martin Luther King Jr. Day special. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. This weekend's weather, mostly sunny with temperatures in the 40s.
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The moon sinks low on the horizon as though it's trying to hide. Frightened animals flee into the woods, even though nothing seems to be chasing them. Nature has turned topsy-turvy. It can mean only one thing. The legislature is back in session. I've seen enough state legislatures in action, Michigan, for example, Florida, and of course Wisconsin, to know that our Texas bunch doesn't have a lock on lunacy, but we certainly have more than our share of loco lawmakers. Take George Lavender. Yes, please. This right-wing peer of the lower chamber became a hero of the Kooky Caucus in 2011 by sponsoring and passing a bill intended to save us Texans from an unspeakable horror: energy-efficient light bulbs. Because of a 2007 federal law enacted by that notorious lefty president George W. Bush, light bulb makers were required to produce high-efficiency bulbs to replace the old energy suckers. "Over my dead body," cried Lavender. It was his Alamo moment as he rose in defense of the holy right of Texans to waste as much energy as we damn well please. To counteract the big bad Fed's outrageous attempt to save energy for America and save money for consumers, Lavender's law invited bulb makers to set up shop here and freely produce the old-style, high-wattage bulbs. Where else but Texas? Imagine how proud Davy Crockett would be to know that he died to make this possible. Unfortunately for Lavender, major bulb makers were already profiting from the burgeoning conservation market, so they had no interest in going backwards. The most disappointing thing to me, Lavender now says dimly, is that we haven't found anyone willing to put in a plant. This is Jim Hightower saying, and that's why the moon hides and animals flee when legislatures convene. It's scary to see so many 5-watt bulbs sitting in 100-watt sockets.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
The CEO of Whole Foods has faced criticism for a statement he made calling President Obama's health care bill fascism. John Mackey took back his comment after a wave of criticism, calling it a poor choice of words. Mackey has previously faced criticism for union busting at Whole Foods and for helping to water down organic standards by partnering with Monsanto. As the CEO of the nation's largest chain of supposedly natural foods, John Mackey has faced multiple petitions from customers challenging his right-wing position on issues of food, health care, and labor. In the interview on NBR that began the latest controversy, Mackey criticized Obama's Affordable Care Act because he sees it as increasing government control over health care. As a free market capitalist, he says the government should not interfere in private industry and that health care is an industry, not a right. He also said the Affordable Care Act will increase costs for businesses, and these costs will be put onto employees. Whole Foods workers have made several attempts to unionize, mainly because of the low wages and lack of benefits they receive, while John Mackey and Whole Foods Corporation take in record profits.
A federal grand jury has charged the former mayor of New Orleans with 21 counts of corruption. Ray Nagin was the mayor of New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina and gained national fame for his criticism of the federal government in the wake of the storm. The charges stem from a city hall corruption investigation that has led to guilty pleas from four other people, including two former city officials. According to the grand jury, from 2005 through 2008, Nagin awarded city contracts in exchange for $200,000 in kickbacks. These included trips to Hawaii and Jamaica, as well as private jet rides to Chicago and Las Vegas. Nagin is the first mayor in the city's 295-year history to face an indictment during federal corruption charges.
It seems everyone's trying to get the attention of new and returning Oregon lawmakers this week. During the legislature's organizational days, briefing sessions are being held to prepare them for the issues they'll soon be facing and voting on. Steve Sherrod, in collaboration with the Oregon News Service, has more.
State lawmakers showed up in Salem this week for their pre-session to get organized and hear the governor's State of the State address, and they're also hearing from a number of advocacy groups, including the AARP. That briefing was about Oregon's long-term care system, which is considered a model in the nation for its focus on home and community-based care as people age. Rick Bennett, with AARP Oregon, says like every year, those services have to compete for limited dollars with other worthy priorities, including public safety, education, and health care.
None of those, frankly, are adequately funded at this time in Oregon. We do have to look at the revenue, particularly how we spend that revenue, not only on direct services, but also on tax expenditures, or what we more commonly think of as tax credits or deductions.
Bennett says the governor's preliminary budget makes many assumptions about trimming state expenses in some areas and boosting revenue in others. But overall, he says the AARP is pleased that Kitzhaber appears to be making long-term care a priority.
Unlike the last several years with our economic downturn, Governor Kitzhaber's budget maintains the current funding of these services, plus provides an extra $30 million in what he's terming investments in our long-term care system. So we're very pleased to see that.
Among the many bills already introduced to raise revenue are a new sales tax on soft drink and hikes in cigarette and gas taxes. For KBOO News, I'm Stephen Sherritt.
The Transportation and Security Administration, or TSA, announced today that they will remove all X-ray body scanners from airports. The body scanners have been widely criticized by privacy advocates who call them a virtual strip search. But the decision to remove the scanners from airports did not result from criticism of the way they invade the privacy of passengers or of the potential health risks from the X-rays. Instead, the scanners were removed because they simply do not work to detect suspicious items on people's bodies. Congress has set today as a deadline for the agency to develop software that would actually work, but the TSA failed to meet that deadline. The X-ray scanners could still come back into operation, however, as TSA is considering a new contract for presumably functional scanners.
The first nest of a rare endangered bird has been discovered in Brazil. The critically endangered Stresemann's bristlewren is one of the world's most rare birds, with fewer than 15 birds known to be in existence. Logging, fires, and cattle ranching in the Amazon basin caused the bristlewren's steep decline. The new sighting of a Stresemann bristlewren nest by two Brazilian researchers includes evidence of baby birds in the nest. It's hard to know for sure because the bristlewren builds a tunnel-style nest that is over 6 feet deep. The researchers called on the Brazilian government to enact stronger protections of the endangered ecosystem to help this and other bird species recover from near extinction.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Meyer, Robin Ryan, Steve Sherritt, and David Coyle. The producer is Zeke Harrington. Special thanks to the reporters at Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Linda Olson-Osterland guest hosts More Talk Radio. Her guest is Trevor Aronson, author of The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. At 9, the Old Mulver